Martin Luther King, of course, has become a crucially important element in the schemes, the plans of the conspiracy for world governance. So we need to really take a look at Martin Luther King. And let's begin by taking a look at the Martin Luther King holiday, January 15th. Consider this. Are you aware that Martin Luther King has been honored above any other American in the history of our country? There used to be Washington's birthday, right? February 22nd. In some other parts of the country, benighted parts of the country, inhabited by Yankees who simply don't know any better, there was a time when there was Lincoln's birthday. Regional holiday, February 12th. Now, those holidays have been merged so that now we have President's Day, right? So you don't really have a holiday that remains that honors any particular president. It's just called President's Day. The only individual in the history of this country who is honored with his own national holiday is Martin Luther King, above Washington. Isn't that odd? Above George Washington, above Thomas Jefferson or some other hero like that you might choose. Now, the usual practice in making a holiday for somebody is to wait a long time after he's dead, until all the facts are in, right? Until all the facts are in and the attitude of the people now has become pretty well settled, then you can be pretty sure, yes, this individual deserves a national holiday. And such was the case, for example, with George Washington, known as the father of our country, until he was demoted and submerged in Residence Day. Yet we have this unbelievable haste to enshrine this one man, Martin Luther King Jr., with his own holiday, even above Washington. If you didn't know anything else about the man, you would know that there was something suspicious about this, something bizarre, peculiar about this. For years, I traveled the country talking about this man, exposing him simply by setting forth the facts about him. In fact, I used to travel around the country to do this with a lady named Julia Brown. Julia Brown was an FBI agent, an FBI undercover agent. She came from Cleveland. We would travel around together. She was a black lady. Wherever she would go, wherever we would go, she took great delight in telling people I was her grandson. And I could see people were, the minute she would say that, I could see people's eyes would narrow, but they were too polite to ask, but they couldn't understand how a black lady could have a grandson as white as Herman Talmadge. But that they, you know, they wanted to know how, that this didn't fit into their knowledge of eugenics, I guess. They couldn't figure out how this could happen, so nobody ever asked. And she took delight in telling people she was my grandmother. And we would travel around the country talking about this man and trying to prevent the turmoil that seemed to break out wherever Martin Luther King went. This was one of the things many people began to wonder about. Here is Martin Luther King, champion of nonviolence. That's what you've been told, right? Okay, he's a champion of nonviolence. He learned this from Gandhi, from studying what they did in India. Yet wherever Martin Luther King would go, turmoil would break out. People scratched their heads. They couldn't understand that this doesn't seem to fit together. Why is this? I remember on one occasion, for example, Martin Luther King's people were going into a town called Sandersville, Georgia. They had already agitated the population to such an extent that the predictable riot was going to break out between the races in this little town, Sandersville, Georgia. My grandmother and I, Mrs. Brown, came to the town and we talked to the population. We had to talk to them on two successive nights because the situation was so dangerous that we couldn't have the blacks and the whites in the town in the same hall the same night. It would have been too dangerous. So one night we talked to the blacks, the next night we talked to the whites. After we finished explaining everything, the turmoil that was supposed to take place completely petered out. There was no riot. The people who had been sent there by the King organization to create this turmoil had to leave town. Nothing happened. And Mrs. Brown would travel following on the trail of Martin Luther King toward the end. And she would make speeches exposing him. She would find out where he was going to appear. She would go there first and talk about him to such an extent that she deflated a considerable part of the contemplated King activity. In fact, I recall at that time speculating that he had become by that time such a liability, I was afraid, I warned my colleagues, something bad could happen to him. Shortly thereafter, he was assassinated. Now, what do we know about this man, actually? Why did turmoil break out wherever he went? You need to take a look at the Saturday Review, April 1965. The Saturday Review is no longer published. It was a New York intellectual magazine, book reviews, articles. At one time it was called the Saturday Review of Literature, and then it was called the Saturday Review. In that issue of the Saturday Review, Martin Luther King had an article. He wrote it explaining what nonviolence was as he practiced it, how it worked. It had four steps. Step one, nonviolent demonstrators go into the street. Step two, racists provoked by the nonviolent demonstrators would unleash violence against them. That was step two in his own plan. Now notice that he's telling you the reason he went into the street was to get the violence, right? All you have to do is read that and the mystery is explained. Why did turmoil, violence break out wherever he went? Because that's what he was going there to get. Step three, a national wave of indignation sweeps throughout the country because these people that he sent into the streets have been attacked by the so-called racists. Step four, the legislation that he wants passed in Congress is passed by the Congress in the backwash, in the wake of that wave of compassion and of sympathy that is unleashed throughout the country because his people have been beaten up in the streets. Now remember we talked, when we looked at the media, we talked about how so much is concealed. The media never showed you what these so-called nonviolent revolutionaries were doing to provoke the anger of the so-called racists. They would do horrible things, especially to provoke the people to react. Again, remember, he said that was why he went into the streets, to provoke violence. All you have to do is read that article. Get that article, Saturday Review, in your local library. It'll be archived, April 1965, and read what he says himself. So that's completely his own article, always the best evidence coming from the man's own mouth, completely eliminates any mystery as to why there always was violence and turmoil wherever the man went. Now, what do we know about Martin Luther King's background? One place you could go to take a look for some of the facts is in my book, It's Very Simple. I think it's on that reading list that I handed out to you a couple of days ago. It's Very Simple, The True Story of Civil Rights. One of my books, if you take a look in there, you'll see some of this. Bayard Rustin was King's secretary. Bayard Rustin was, of course, a practicing sodomite. He spent his entire life in Communist Party activities. He actually demanded, now this is Bayard Rustin, King's secretary talking. Bayard Rustin demanded that, quote, more bloody Negro suffering should be encouraged so that squeamish Northern Negroes would be horrified into life, end quote. Does that sound like nonviolence to you? This is what the man said. This is the man running King's organization for Martin Luther King. He says, more bloody Negro suffering should be encouraged. What kind of nonviolence is that? There was also a man named Hunter Pitts Odell. You'll see his picture in my book. It's very simple. Hunter Pitts Odell ran King's organization as executive secretary. Odell was also a member of the National Committee of the Communist Party. The media of the time kept exposing Odell. Every once in a while, he would be exposed. Reporters would say, well, Dr. King, this man running your organization, Hunter Pitts Odell, he's a member of the National Committee of the Communist Party, they would ask Dr. King. King pretended to fire him. He would say, well, oh, yeah, we fired this man. He's no longer working for us. The reporters would say, well, okay, he's fired. Later on, Odell would turn up running a different part of King's organization in a different city. He never was fired. King was lying. But the thing that always has amused me is that after my book on King was published, my book on King came out, it sold 500,000 copies. After the book was published, we learned more about King's communist activities and his other activities than we knew before. In other words, there was more that we uncovered later than there actually is in the book. I had to write many magazine articles to catch up. For instance, when I wrote It's Very Simple, I did not yet know about Stanley Levison. Who was Stanley Levison? Suddenly, at one point in his career, toward the end, King started to make speeches about the war in Vietnam. The war in Vietnam is going on at the same time, right? King has been talking about civil rights, civil rights. Suddenly now, he interjects himself into the debate about Vietnam. Well-meaning Americans scratch their heads. What does this have to do with civil rights? Especially because his speeches sounded like enemy propaganda cooked up in Hanoi. His speeches started to sound, speeches about Vietnam started to sound like communist propaganda. The reason was that Stanley Levison was writing those speeches. Who was Stanley Levison? Stanley was the paymaster in this country for the KGB, the Soviet Secret Police. Can you believe this? This is the man whose holiday, national holiday, we are honoring above George Washington every January 15th. The KGB would send Stanley the rubles to pay for all Soviet activities in the United States, and Stanley would distribute the money to the different Soviet operators in the United States, in this country. How high up in the Soviet apparatus would you have to be, do you think, for them to trust you enough to send you a big bucket of rubles and tell you, distribute this money among our different operators, different programs in the United States? You'd have to be pretty high up in the apparatus, wouldn't you? This was Stanley Levison. Stanley Levison, paymaster for the Soviet KGB, financed Martin Luther King and wrote his speeches. In other words, Martin Luther King was being financed by a hostile power, hostile to the United States, with whom we were indirectly at war in Vietnam, you could certainly make a case that we were talking about treason here. This is the man whose holiday has been imposed upon us every year, January 15th, above Washington. The giveaway of all this, the giveaway to all of this, is that even King's admirers, unable to staunch the extrusion of treason and filth we are talking about, even his admirers reluctantly admitted. For instance, see the work of Professor David J. Garrow. Now, David J. Garrow is a King scholar. He's written a lot about Martin Luther King. He is sympathetic to Martin Luther King. He's not attacking Martin Luther King. He supports him. He admires him. David J. Garrow will give you a lot, will give you lots of information about these activities. Now, there are five important aspects of Martin Luther King's career. By the way, even his name is phony. His name is Michael King, not Martin Luther King. That's his real name. There are five important aspects of Michael King's career. Number one, the violence that always erupted in a King demonstration. We've taken a look at that. Number two, his Communist Party activities. Number three, his plagiarism. Number four, his sexual pathology. Number five, his pagan beliefs. Let's take a look now. We've taken a look at the first two, briefly, the first two elements in his career. Let's take a look at his plagiarism. After King was killed, and again, I knew nothing about this when I wrote It's Very Simple. I was totally unaware of it. After King was killed, which made a valuable martyr out of a man who had become a liability because he had been so well exposed. After he was killed, the professors went to work on his writings. Their motive was not to speak ill of the dead. They loved, admired, even revered King, and wanted to give his writings the same treatment that they would give any other so-called great man's. Of course, all of this should have been done before the national holiday was proclaimed, right? That's why you have to wait a long time after a man is dead until all the facts are known. Until you go through all of the things that he's done, everything he's said, everything he's written. You give the people plenty of time to make up their own minds without it being imposed upon him what kind of a man this was. Instead, first they do the holiday, then they begin to investigate. What did they find? Remember, these are professors who are King's supporters. What did they find? They were astounded and horrified, even shocked. Shocked, as they say in Casablanca. Shocked to discover that their hero was a slovenly, semi-literate writer who had plagiarized most of what he, quote, wrote, end quote. Plagiarism is the literary version of bank robbery. It is theft, it is stealing. That is why the federal government rightly guarantees copyright in this country. You've all seen videos you get from Blockbuster. The first thing that comes on the screen is, if you copy this and use it illegitimately, the FBI will investigate, right? First thing it says on the screen, protection of copyright. You violate a copyright, off to jail you go. A literary work is a property just as much as a piece of real estate is, and the copyright does the same thing a land title does. It's one of the few legitimate purposes of the federal government to protect copyright. That is why movie makers pay millions for the right to film best-selling books. But Michael King, Martin Luther King, plagiarized as prolifically as the young Stalin robbed banks. For example, browse through a book entitled The Martin Luther King Jr. Plagiarism Story by Theodore Pappas. published by the Rockford Institute, Rockford, Illinois, in 1994. He explains that in 1984, the Martin Luther King Papers Project was launched at Stanford University. In 1986, Professor David J. Garrow, I mentioned him a few moments ago, in his book, Bearing the Cross, wrote that big chunks of King's stride toward freedom are identical to passages from Paul Ramsey's Basic Christian Ethics and Anders Nygren's Eros and Agape. Apparently, what King did was he just lifted huge chunks of the writing of other people from their books and claimed that it was his own. Now remember, we're getting this from David J. Garrow. He's an admirer of King's. He's not telling us this to attack King. He's trying to excuse it. And that's why Garrow doesn't call what King did plagiarism. Garrow doesn't like that word in this context. He calls the incident ghostwriting. He calls this ghostwriting, what King did. No. A ghostwriter is someone who is hired to write something by the person whose name will appear on the cover as the author. A ghostwriter is not someone who steals what someone else writes and puts his own name on the cover. For example, I've been a ghostwriter. That means you write a book for somebody, your name doesn't appear, his name appears on it, but you wrote it. I'm not going to tell you what I wrote. The main reason I'm not going to tell you what I wrote is that after I got finished writing it, the guy I wrote this particular book for completely wrecked it, changed everything, ruined it, and the book collapsed. Preposterous story. According to a timeline about what Martin Luther King did, the King Papers Project first discovered evidence of King's plagiarism in late 1987. In October 1989, according to Wall Street Journal reporter Peter Waldman, the professors discussed King's plagiarism in the presence of his widow, Coretta Scott King, in an all-day meeting in Atlanta. They met with Mrs. King to discuss this, looking for a way out, a way to explain this. Now that they've committed themselves, they're admirers of this man, they discover now gradually, it's like a detective story. They gradually begin to unfold the enormity of what this man has done, the phony foundations upon which his phony reputation is based. They're shocked, they're horrified. What are we going to do? Let's meet with his widow. Maybe she can tell us what to do. Mrs. King remained silent through most of the meeting and has since declined to answer queries about her husband's thefts. Well, after all, what can she say? What could you say about it? There it is, it's on the printed page in front of you. The board decided to publish King's papers with footnotes fully detailing the plagiarism and to publish a separate article outlining its extent. On December 3rd, 1989, Frank Johnson revealed in the British Sunday Telegraph, by the way, that reminds me to tell you something. It's pathetic, but so many times to find out what's happening in this country, we have to read the foreign media. Did you know that? I forgot to mention that the other night. So many times in order to find out what's happening here, I have to read the London Telegraph, the London Times, Agence France-Presse, the French news agency, to find out what's happening here. Does that tell you anything? In the British Sunday Telegraph, Frank Johnson revealed that Ralph Luker, associate editor of the King Papers Project, said King had borrowed heavily from the thesis of Jack Boozer, fellow Boston University theology student, who later became professor of religion at Emory University. While Jack Boozer was away in the military, listen to this, Jack Boozer writes his essay, leaves for the military. While he is gone, Mike King, Martin Luther King, steals his essay. In September 1990, Thomas Fleming wrote in Chronicles that King's doctorate should be regarded as a courtesy title because of the revelation that he plagiarized his dissertation. If the truth were to get out, Boston University would have been humiliated. It is a short distance from BU to PU. So BU President John Westling sent a letter to Chronicles, published in the January 1991 issue, denying Fleming's charge. Westling said King's dissertation had been, quote, scrupulously examined and re-examined by scholars, end quote, and that, quote, not a single instance of plagiarism of any sort has been identified. Not a single reader has ever found any non-attributed or misattributed quotations, misleading paraphrases, or thoughts borrowed without due scholarly reference in any of its 343 pages, end quote. This is what this is what Boston University President John Westling said to protect the reputation of this man and his own reputation as the president of Boston University. Claiborne Carson was director of the project for Boston University. He denied all charges until Waldman said he had a copy of Boozer's dissertation. Then Claiborne Carson caved when confronted with the evidence on paper. The story appeared on the front page of the Wall Street Journal on November 9, 1990. The article quoted Claiborne Carson finally admitting King's plagiarism, but it calls his thievery borrowings and voice merging. A new term for theft, voice merging. They said, this derives from the oral traditions of the black church. This is from the oral traditions of the black church. This explains his thievery. The article says, most of King's papers had many original thoughts, but often borrowed without citing. According to Waldman, Carson was asking staff members to refrain from use of the P word at work. You talk about the N word. With regard to this subject, the word they didn't want to utter was the P word, plagiarism. In short, even the author of the expose leaned over backward far enough to do an Olympic flip. Compare what would be done to anyone else you know, black, white, or whatever, who commits misrepresentation as outrageous as King's. He would be stripped of his degree. Jerry Hardison was a professor of chemistry at the University of Nebraska. He is certainly not a right-winger. He is full of praise for the civil rights movement. He's worth quoting at length. This is what this professor of chemistry at the University of Nebraska says. He says, like most graduate students, King spent the first half of his doctoral work taking courses in his degree area, theology. His surviving papers from that period show that from the very beginning, he was transcribing articles by eminent theologians, often word for word, and representing them as his own work. After completing his coursework, graduate students usually write a dissertation or thesis, supposedly an independent and original contribution to scholarship. King's thesis was anything but original. In fact, the sheer extent of his plagiarism is breathtaking. Page after page contains nothing but direct verbatim transcriptions of the work of others. In 1990, the King Project estimated that less than half of some chapters was actually written by King himself. Since then, even more of his borrowings have been traced. But most unforgivably, we're still quoting Jerry Hardison, professor of chemistry at the University of Nebraska, most unforgivably of all, thousands of words in paragraph-sized chunks were taken from the thesis of a fellow student, Jack Boozer, ex-Army chaplain, who returned to BU after the war to get his degree. We even know how he did it, for King was systematic in his plagiarism. He copied significant phrases, sentences, or whole paragraphs from the books he was consulting onto a set of index cards. Writing a thesis was then a matter of arranging these cards into a meaningful order. Sometimes he linked the stolen parts together with an occasional phrase of his own, but as often as not, he left the words completely unchanged. The index cards still survive with their damning evidence intact. King fooled everybody, his advisor, his thesis reader, and King scholars for more than 30 years. Everything I've written above can easily be verified in a couple of hours in Love Library. None of it comes from right-wing scandal mongers, says Professor Harbison, who might have a vested interest in damaging King's reputation. In other words, Martin Luther King Jr. was a fiction, a phantasm, manufactured and maintained by the communists who chose him because of his oratorical talent, groomed him, used him, protected him, and then probably eliminated him when he became a liability. The Martin Luther King we were told about did not exist, never did exist. Now let's take a quick look at Martin Luther King's Christianity. Remember, he was a reverend. He was supposed to have a doctorate in theology. Christianity, we are told, was the inspiration for everything he did. What did he believe? Among the papers with one, with his name on it, is one entitled, What Experiences of Christians Living in the Early Christian Century Led to the Christian Doctrines of the Divine Sonship of Jesus, the Virgin Birth, and the Bodily Resurrection. Doesn't the title itself tell us something is wrong? The title itself tells us something is fatally wrong here. These doctrines came not from anyone's experience, but from history and from what Jesus said, right? Not from something any man concocted. But King says this, these doctrines are historically and philosophically untenable. That's what it says, philosophically untenable. Maybe that's a typographical error, quite possible. Here is how Jesus got to be divine, according to Dr. King. The first doctrine of our discussion, which deals with the divine sonship of Jesus, went through a great process of development. Development is spelled D-E-V-E-L-O-P-E-N-E-N-T. Another typo? Maybe. How then did this doctrine of divine sonship come into being? We may find a partial clue to the actual rise of this doctrine in the spreading of Christianity into the Greco-Roman world. Anything that possessed flesh was always underminded. Underminded. That's what it says. I don't know what the word means in Greek thought. And so in order to receive inspiration from Jesus, the Greeks had to apotheosize him. He says, as Headley laconically states, the church had found God in Jesus, and so it called Jesus the Christ. And later, under the influence of Greek thought forms, the only begotten Son of God. In short, according to King, it was the Greeks who made Jesus divine. My guess is that King really did write this because it is so incompetent. This is the writing of a mediocre high school sophomore, not of a man with a doctorate. This is supposed to be the writing of a man with a PhD. A high school sophomore could do better than this. You could. But the most damning indictment is, again, as you see here, he tells us in effect, it was Greek thought that made Jesus divine. Would a Christian say? How do we know Jesus was divine? He said so. If God has not given you the faith to believe, you don't have it. You don't believe. That's right. It's a mystery. This is what Scripture tells us. It had nothing to do with Greeks making Jesus divine. Here is King on the virgin birth. First, we must admit that the evidence for the tenability of this doctrine is too shallow to convince any objective thinker. Instead of too, T-O-O, it says T-T-O. Maybe that's another typo. So he says that the tenability for the doctrine of the virgin birth is very shallow. Finally, consider that the resurrection is the master doctrine of Christian belief. Correct? Catholics believe in resurrection, in the resurrection of Jesus. Protestants believe it. Without the resurrection, there is no Christianity. Didn't Paul say that? Paul somewhere says, well, if there was no resurrection, if Jesus wasn't resurrection, he says, go home, forget about it, it's useless. There's no religion. We've got no Christianity. There is just another wise man, in other words. If you don't believe in the resurrection, go your way in peace, but you are not a Christian. So what does Dr. King believe about the resurrection? He says, the last doctrine in our discussion deals with the resurrection story. This doctrine, upon which the Easter faith rests, symbolizes the ultimate Christian conviction that Christ conquered death. From a literary, historical, and philosophical point of view, this doctrine raises many questions. In fact, the external evidence for the authenticity of this doctrine is found wanting. This is the word of a Christian preacher, a Baptist preacher. Have you ever heard of a Baptist preacher who says the doctrine of resurrection, the resurrection of Jesus, is found wanting? He says, King says, the apostles loved Jesus so much they invented the doctrine of resurrection. This is what King says. The apostles invented this. Remember, after the crucifixion, the apostles are totally demoralized, right? They still don't understand what he told them. They never did really understand until he was gone. They're totally demoralized. He's been crucified. He's dead. They're looking at each other. He wasn't who he said he was. They're stunned. They're looking at each other. He's gone. Suddenly, there is a light. Jesus says, you know, I haven't been dead as long as Lazarus, but still, I'm really hungry. Could I have something to eat? He says, Thomas, put your hand in my side. Thomas says, no, I don't want to do it. Well, then Thomas says, well, wait a minute. I've been carrying on about this all along. Now he's telling me to do what I said I wanted to do all along. I better do it. Thomas goes over, sticks his hand in his side, sticks his fingers in the holes. My Lord and my God. King says, they made all this up. This is a Baptist preacher? No. So, Dr. King was not a Christian. This is not even a criticism. There are lots of people who are not Christians. I don't criticize them. It's none of my business. This is God's work. God decides who are the elect. God decides who has been chosen before the foundation of the world. It's got nothing to do with me. God can handle this without my help. I don't need to worry about it. So I'm not even criticizing it. But if you don't believe these basic things that a Christian believes, it's very simple, you're not a Christian. And Dr. King was not a Christian. Along these lines, King was an ardent supporter of Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood, of course, is the abortion organization. He won the Margaret Sanger Award in 1966. He said there is a striking kinship between our movement and Margaret Sanger's early efforts. a kinship between what he was doing, he says, and Margaret Sanger's efforts. So who was Margaret Sanger? What was she doing? Mrs. Sanger's early efforts included agitation to limit the procreation of the inferior races and publishing the work of Nazi propagandists. Who were the inferior races? What did she mean by inferior races? Charlotte Smith is whom she meant by the inferior races. I always thought he was superior. Maybe you do too. She says, he's part of the inferior races. We have to limit the procreation of these people, according to Margaret Sanger. King says his efforts and her efforts had a strong kinship. She also published, again, the work of Nazi propagandists. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, finally, there was King's career as a sexual predator. Now remember, we're talking about a Baptist preacher. Tell me how many Baptist preachers you've ever heard of who have habits like this. We are not just talking about a world-class philanderer like Jack Kennedy. Remember, Jack Kennedy had fiddle and faddle in the White House, they were called. Two ladies, fiddle and faddle, among many others. We're not just talking about something like that. We're talking about a genuine sexual psychopath. How do we know this? We know it because FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover tapped King's telephones and bugged King's activities. Why did Hoover do that? He did it because his boss, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy, a certified demigod in the liberal pantheon, ordered him to. The Kennedys had become aware of King's communist activities, and they were worried. The Kennedys brought King to the White House, where the president himself, Jack Kennedy, warned King that what he was doing was dangerous. They told King, they said, look, we're for you, we're with you, you know that, but you're involved with these dangerous people, you're involved in these dangerous activities. You need to know who these people are, we're warning you. So King knew exactly what he was doing. The President of the United States brought him to the White House and told him, hey, this is dangerous, you have to do something about this. They wanted to know what he was up to, hence the wiretaps and bugs. What did they find out? Because the truth is so putrid, some of it has leaked. For example, Mary Starrett was a television anchor woman for 21 years. She's had her own talk show. This is just one example. In her column, her nationally syndicated column, she writes about, quote, this is a quote, a naked Dr. King running down the hallway of a Norwegian hotel chasing a woman during his trip to accept the Nobel Prize, end quote. What? He's in Oslo. He's there to accept the Nobel Prize, and the night before he's going to get the prize, he's running naked down the hallway of his hotel chasing a woman. He's a Baptist minister. What? Can you name any other Baptist ministers who are doing this? In a story in the Atlanta Journal dated March 31, 1965, Congressman William Dickinson was quoted as saying that, quote, all night sessions of debauchery took place in a church. On the night before he was killed, King participated in another orgy. He hired prostitutes and paid for them with church money. He beat at least one of them up. This is the night before he was killed. He's still at it. Mary Starrett writes as follows. According to one source, there are over 60,000 censored pages. 60,000 censored pages we are not allowed to see. While a small amount of this material has been released under the Freedom of Information Act, the rest has been labeled obscene. King's own son has expressed the belief that his father was killed in a massive conspiracy by those who saw the elder King's behavior, long-term depression, and alcohol abuse to be a liability they couldn't afford. So apparently, according to King's son, he was also an abuser of alcohol, according to his son. At the request of Mrs. King, a court has sequestered that evidence until the year 2027. You will get to find out what's in those sequestered pages, 60,000 pages. I'll be dead by then. You will find out. Of course, that's long enough to milk everything possible from the myth. Remember, again, we are talking about a man who is presently honored above Washington. Can you believe that you've got 60,000 pages of sequestered material about this man that we are not allowed to see, which obviously contain material worse than I have presented to you this morning? It's secret, it's hidden, at the request of Mrs. King, yet we're honoring this man above Washington. The fact that Martin Luther King Day exists is proof of how completely the revolution has triumphed so far. The fact that they can put a complete scoundrel, a charade, a totally manufactured public relations image up to this exalted position is proof of how far they have come. This is what you have to do something about, you have to be aware of. Always carry this information with you. You now have been armed with the truth about this man. I hope this information has been helpful to you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, as always, for your attention. God bless you. Good luck.